This is Jason Q. Citizen and Friends on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back to the second hour of the Jason Q. Citizen and Friends program. And wow, that was some interview we had there with George Eliason in the first hour, George being based in the Ukraine, in the region of Donbass itself, and profound. If you get a chance, go back and have a look on the Jason Q. Citizen page there and download that interview when it turns up tomorrow. Just something else. And I tell you what, this hour is going to be just as good, but we're returning to Australian soil now. And I'm going to introduce you to Rob Cribb shortly. And we're going to discuss a whole range of topics around the economy and what's going on. And you're going to get access to an actual political party policy director. And I would encourage anyone to drop me a message if you can, and we can even probably ask the questions in the show. You can do that via the website, just about how we're going to speculate perhaps on different ways to get ourselves out of the messes that we're in now, because we are in one big giant pile of dung. And no one in power seems to know what's going on. So what do? We've got to get new people into office, and we've got to be able to see big, think big, and act big. And that's probably why people like Trump were so successful and why Georgia Maloney is a great big breath of fresh air now as she defends what it is, and that being country, God, and family. They are what all people in the freedom movement are flocking to, the nationalists against the globalists, God over atheism, and family where it's being divided and conquered. First of all, we saw it with the vaccine, that families weren't allowed to see each other, and then we had them fighting against each other if they dared resist and use their right to informed consent. And it was certainly a breath of fresh air to learn that Georgia Maloney said that she wouldn't be vaccinating her daughter against COVID because the likelihood of a child dying from it is tantamount to being struck by lightning. Well said, Giorgia Meloni, new Italian Prime Minister. But we're faced with another scenario here in Australia right now, that it turns out that our own Reserve Bank is technically insolvent, if you can believe that. They disclosed a $44 billion valuation loss on its bond portfolio and is now $12.4 billion upside down, according to the Deputy Governor, Michelle Bullock. But they're too big to fail. She says if any commercial entity had negative equity, assets would be insufficient to meet liabilities. Therefore, the company would not be a going concern, said Ms. Bullock, before adding that different rules apply to central banks that can create money, and that ability for it to do so would mean that its job was unaffected. I mean, what is money if you can literally just create it to get yourself out of trouble? At that point, why are we just doing anything at all? Why wouldn't you just say, you know what, bank, shove it, we're not going to pay our bills anymore, and just crush the whole damn system. I'll keep what I own, you keep what you own, and we'll start again. And that's part of what people talk about when they talk about Nasara and Jusara, the great global reset in favor of the people. And then, of course, you've got Klaus Schwab talking about his great reset, you'll own nothing and be happy. So clearly all of this is going somewhere. It's not just that we just got into this mess accidentally, or because a virus accidentally appeared on the radar and we all had to just follow with a one-size-fits-all solution that fitted nobody at all. So the activities, the stories, the fights, the wars, the skirmishes, the Russia-Ukraine, the Russiagate, the Danchenko, the US, the green energy situation, the windmills being put up and the trees being chopped down to make way for them. I mean, come on, this is all part of a great big agenda that's happening. And in the meantime, we learn in the local media that two or three cups of coffee a day are linked to a longer life. Well, talk about providing us a little bit of hope after we've been told that there's 943 different ways to have a heart attack except take the vaccine for the last 6 months. And now we're learning of probably the greatest help for those that are opposed to digital ID, the Optus hack, is now turning in all different directions. and we're seeing that developments every day. So first of all, we learn about the hacker there telling us that what's going on is that they want money to because they've stolen individuals' data from up to 40% of the Australian population. And then another story that's come out today and reported by Channel 7 is that on the Optus Data Forum, somebody has posted that appears to be the same hacker, this comment: too many eyes, we will not sail. And there's a lot of spelling errors in here and grammatical errors. It sounds like it could be from someone, a Chinese national, a Russian national, Ukraine national, by the way that they're talking. So I'll read it again. Too many eyes. We will not sail data to anyone. We can't, if even want to, personally delete a data from Drive. It's the only copy. Sorry to 10,200 Australians whose data was leaked. Australia will see no gain in fraud. This can't be monitored. Maybe for 10,200 Australians, but the rest of the population, no. Very sorry to you. Deepest apology to Optus for this. Hope all goes well from this. Optus, if you are reading, we would have reported exploit if you had method to contact. No security mail, no bug bounties, no way to message. Ransom not paid, but we do not care anymore. It was a mistake to scrape published data in the first place. This is an absolutely extraordinary turn of events. It feels like we're watching a movie that Mel Gibson was in, or someone, or Bruce Willis or something like that. But the best thing about it is if you are still supporting a digital ID, then you've got rocks in your head, and any politician worth his or her salt will have to say, okay, we need to go back to the drawing board here. Sometimes in tyranny comes a solution and freedom will resolve. Now, did you know that there are many ways that you can listen to TNT Radio? Why not stream us direct from our website on your desktop, tablet or mobile device, or download our app from the App Store? We even stream live on YouTube, Rumble and Odyssey. We've got you covered here on TNT Radio.
Keeping the commitment.
I love you guys.
Unbelievable.
24/7.
Listen to you every day, have for years.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Rob Cribb is an Australian economist who lives on the mid-north coast of New South Wales. He currently works as a probability consultant and has been employed in sports journalism, accountancy and campaign management. For over a decade, Rob has been a member of the Liberal Democrats, where he currently serves as New South Wales Policy Director and sits on the National and New South Wales executives. Last year, he spearheaded the development of the Freedom Manifesto and helped the party regain relevance by courting high-profile recruits such as Ross Cameron and John Ruddick. Rob Cribb, welcome to Jason Q, Citizen and Friends.
Thank you, Jason, so much for having me on.
Oh, look, it's a delight to have you, Rob. And we've had quite the group from the Liberal Democratic Party, and we're always met with brilliant analysis, brilliant personalities, and encouragement that there is another way to skin the cat on the political realm that exists. And we've all been out there and had a shot and a go at all this and been disappointed about what's come. But what's fantastic is that this is just consolidating the most determined people to rewrite the way that politics is played in this country. And Rob, you're right in the center of all of this. How do you feel about it after what we've gone through? Are you motivated more than ever, or do you feel like there's just a whole lot of effort that's got to go into this and we may not ever see a result?
No, I am motivated more than ever. So I've been in this party for a long time, as you said, I think over a decade. And I think one of the great silver linings that we get from a series of authoritarian governments, so we don't just have one, we have our federal government and all our state governments that have almost gone off the cliff in terms of telling us how to live and, you know, who to associate with. The great silver lining of this is that you get more libertarians when you have an authoritarian government. And you don't necessarily get a majority straight away. But I think in my time in the Liberal Democrats, we considered, you know, potentially 1-2% of people were actually libertarians. And I think that's probably gone from about 1-2% to about 5% in reaction to people now seeing the dangers of giving government all the power that we have given them, that they will use it in ways that they certainly shouldn't, and they will manipulate, you know, the media and our schooling systems to advance their agendas. And I think more and more people are waking up to this because of what has happened. So it is a great silver lining. And I'm more optimistic than ever that we can build a genuine libertarian movement and push back against authoritarian governments, because I think they've bitten off more than they can chew.
Well, there is absolutely no question that when you look at the cast of hundreds that fill up Parliament House, that many of them are simply not qualified for the jobs that they do. We constantly hear stories of them not reading legislation before voting upon it, and therefore kowtowing to this overarching globalist agenda that is sending us down a certain pathway, this green energy obsession, the idea of completely ignoring all of the government debt that's been accrued by the fiscally supposedly conservative Liberal government that's now been replaced by a Labor government. We hear stories of a responsible tight budget from Jim Chalmers that we'll wait and see. And Jim Chalmers managed to put his foot in it this week by coming out and making a promise that couldn't be kept when he said that the 23-cent excise reduction from the Liberal government in a cynical attempt to try and win votes that it didn't win from the last government that was set, a discount that was set to expire last week, September. He said that what will happen is that the fuel companies have gone out there and they've bought all this fuel, so they've already got in at the lower excise rate and petrol prices won't go up. Well, I said that they will go up. They'll go up a day later and they'll go up by more than 23 cents. And that was affirmed when literally the next day they went up by 46 cents a litre, capitalising on the price hike. So Chalmers hasn't got any credibility. They're playing in areas, these politicians, that they aren't qualified to play in. And it feels like that all of us are just being constantly manipulated. But I guess from a Liberal Democratic perspective now, is it a bridge too far for the average person in the street to recognize the authoritarian consecutive governments, as you described, to automatically progress to make them become libertarians? Can people do that, or do they have to incrementally inch across before they realize, hey, there is somewhere else I can go in this, and I'm now actively engaged. I hate authoritarianism.
I do think it has to be incremental in a way. So I think the latter part of what you said, that is how people wake up. They do think that they hate authoritarianism, but it's not going to be everyone at once. And I think we need to understand this when we go through these battles, like the last federal election we just went through. And, you know, the Liberal Democrats, as specifically a party, and the freedom movement as a whole, probably didn't do as well as many people would have hoped. But if you like add up the votes between people who are consciously voting for freedom in that election and compare it to other elections, it was far higher. So I think it does need to be incremental, and people need to, I suppose, realize that it's not going to be a quick fix, that you're going to convince one person at a time and it's going to take a while, but we are making progress. And I think it's important to not lose hope in that way.
Yeah, well said. I think the overnight learning of the election success of Georgia Maloney has breathed new life into the freedom movement. She has come out and specifically said that we will defend country, God, and family. This must be very encouraging for the entire freedom movement, who we notice that the freedom movement is based on nationalism, that is anti-globalist. That's something that we can draw a line in the sand. It's also very much for freedom, and that means free will. So therefore, that is pro-creator or God. That's why we're finding many, many people who never talked about belief before are starting to talk about religion in a healthy way, and more from a, not necessarily from just going to church because the churches have let people down, but the actual discovery of the pureness of belief. And then, of course, it goes towards the family, the nuclear family, which is has been absolutely attacked through all of the COVID period. And then coming out of that through the whole trans agenda that has meant that that you can't even identify, you can't even talk about the fact that you're a man or a woman anymore for fear that you may offend someone who identifies as something different. So do you feel that the election of Maloney is at least a stepping stone towards the direction that we're trying to head in, or is it something else? Does it provide you encouragement?
It does provide me with some encouragement. There are some aspects of, you know, her campaign that are more populist than libertarian, but I do believe that any step away from centralized political power is good. And she's very much, she's, you know, against tighter integration with the EU. She's for more devolution towards church and family and less towards the state. And I think this is why people have voted for her, regardless of what she says about potentially some other issues that people don't like her on. I think this is why she's garnering support, that people want power devolved closer to the individual and further away from centralized political power. So I think this is very encouraging.
Yeah, look, it certainly is. It at least it provides hope, which is something that the freedom movement hasn't had. They haven't had a victory as such in the last election here in Australia. We had technically, apart from the One Nation party getting Pauline, the leader, getting re-elected. The only real surprise was that the United Australia Party managed to get Ralph Babette elected to the Senate out of Victoria. So that was something. But compared to the Teals, of course, it wasn't quite there. So this is a big deal for us, and so it's a building, it's a stepping stone, and very encouraging. Of course, Rob, we've got state elections coming up, both in Victoria and in New South Wales, that will be very encouraging. And what we'll do is we'll take a quick break, and when we come back, we'll probably explore a little bit more in what's happening with the party, therefore, and the plans for the upcoming state elections. And from there, we'll extrapolate further in the interview about the real issues that are affecting Australians. And nothing is more terrifying at the moment than runaway inflation and runaway interest rates. This is TNT Radio.
Politically incorrect on TNT Radio.
When do you think our governments started to become so corrupt? 30, 40 years ago? I get the impression it's been a process, unfortunately. A friend of mine used a comment the other day about too many of our politicians, WIIFM, what's in it for me? And that's a very sad reflection on the quality of the individual that we now have lording things over us. But do you have an idea when it might have started to be so hopeless?
The Commonwealth being able to make laws for Aboriginal people, which provided them with the mechanisms to distort history, which they have over a number of decades, in order to create this Native Title Act, which is designed by the UN, which Keating only consulted with five hand-selected failed leaders he trusted, in order to actually stop the progress of Australia by cutting off the opportunity to use all the land under subject to Native Title, which is a title that individuals cannot own, to stop Australia from exploiting its natural resources to our benefit. It's not for Aboriginal people. Definitely one of the key ways they're undermining the Australian nation is through Aboriginal people.
Weekends are better when you spend it with Mike Tennessee and Richard Carson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
I view Al Sharpton as a poverty pimp.
Terrorism from white supremacy is the most lethal threat to the homeland.
I walk outside every day in fear of white supremacy right here in the middle of the hood. Okay, yeah, right.
My grandparents had a cross burned on their property. We were slaves in the past. We're free now.
I never seen a white supremacist in my life. Never, and they can't point to one. Where the hell are they? I wish somebody would introduce me to a white supremacist. I would like to talk to them and take pictures with them because I never seen one in my life.
Biden says that the country is systematically racist. You know, I almost want to look at him and say, haven't you been the system for the last 50 years?
He's the one that sponsored the 1994 crime bill, which unequivocally basically targeted black men in black neighborhoods.
The polarization, the left versus right, the black versus white.
Pro-choice against pro-life.
I work for Black Lives Matter. I'm sorry that I scared you.
People have had to make it like they're apologizing for their whiteness.
And could you just please apologize for, you know, for your white privilege?
What's more disheartening to me is that those who are within the black community are allowing for that to take place.
So really what we're dealing with is a cultural Marxism that Joe Biden and all the rest from the left we're trying to inculcate into our society.
Well, you were once the oppressor, so now I must be the oppressor. You don't avenge evil for evil.
It's okay to say disparaging things against white people. Our former president, Barack Obama, said it, you know, about old white men are a problem, except when it comes time for him to fly around on their airplanes and ride around on their yachts or be their next door neighbors or endorse them for president like Joe Biden. then old white men are okay. This is their last gasp.
What do progressive socialists really want?
Watch Systematic Deception at salemnow.com.
You have the power of information, lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Jason Q Citizen and Friends program. I'm here with Rob Cribb, who acts as the New South Wales State Policy Director for the Liberal Democratic Party. What a time to be able to ask about the upcoming elections in both Victoria and New South Wales. Clearly, Victoria's coming first, Rob, but you've got to be pretty excited about going on down there. I mean, it's going to be a challenge because the general public are still enamored with Daniel Andrews, probably more feeling like they're threatened than anything else. But with two sitting upper house members, both in Tim Quilty and David Limbrick, this has got to provide the party with much needed muscle and determination.
Yeah, so we have been the real opposition in Victoria, and this is not just a self-imposed sort of description. We have been described as this many times by, you know, neutral media observers. And I think it's something that we'd like to own, that we are the only real opposition in Victoria, because Dan Andrews and his reign of tyranny was supported by the Liberal Party, you know, 90% of the time. So if people think that just getting rid of Dan Andrews will solve the issues, if they replace Dan Andrews with the Liberal Party, considering how often they have agreed with Dan Andrews, it's not going to work out very well for them. And I think people are waking up to this, or at least I hope they are, and they will return David and Tim and potentially elect, you know, a couple more Liberal Democrats in the upper house to make sure that no matter which party ends up forming government in the lower house, they will have a real opposition to hold them to account on these sort of government overreach issues.
Now, what kind of policies are the is the party going to take to the people in Victoria that's going to motivate and excite them?
Well, so the Victorian campaign will be talking about these emergency powers that we have, you know, viscerally opposed, and talking about integrity and prosperity in Victoria, but, you know, mainly to make sure that this can never happen again, what has just happened in Victoria. Mm. To make sure that we get people elected so that we're the balance of power in the upper house, you know, potentially get someone elected in the lower house as well. But realistically, to have the balance of power in the upper house, to not just be two members, to be four members, and make sure that nothing can pass through the upper house that's disagreed between the two major parties if the Liberal Democrats say, no, we're going to stop you. And if we look at what just happened the last term in Victoria, having someone that can just stand there and say, no, you're not going to pass this, would be invaluable. So that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sure that this can never happen again, what has just happened.
It's eternally upsetting, isn't it, when you have an opposition that is anything but an opposition, doesn't oppose a tyrannical government and goes along seemingly to what get along and who exactly are you trying to get along with? I would have thought that any government, regardless of what the so-called crisis was to oppose, and this bipartisan attitude that came out there that was basically letting Andrews do whatever he wanted and have people, as we've seen in Victoria, the most nerve-wracking of all was when you saw on social media that a social media post resulted in a pregnant mother having her home raided by police because she's not allowed to speak. Is this even Australia? And these are the types of moments that we must never ever forget when we go to the ballot yet again for another election and say, hang on a second, there is a line in the sand here that's been drawn, and this is but one of them. It doesn't matter. And if anything, the proof in the pudding is in the eating. This virus has been so overblown by all of it. And now we're seeing new stories coming out that are showing us that, in fact, the unvaccinated were probably the ones that did the best out of all of this. If you're under the age of 70 and you're a normal, healthy person, you had no risk, virtually no risk of succumbing. And this was the entire healthy working population. So why then do we have to live like this? So clearly there must have been another agenda in all of it, Rob.
Yeah, no, I agree. And as I said, the Liberal Democrats have been the only opposition to any of this. So the Liberal Party has gone along with 90% of it. And there's a big push to, you know, just get Dan out by any means necessary. And I do agree that it would be good if Dan was no longer Premier. But you can't just replace him with someone who agreed with 90% of what he said. You need to make sure that there's a real opposition to hold whoever's Premier to account in the upper house. And the next crisis that they whip up fear about won't be COVID. It will be something else. We all now, you know, vaguely know that COVID was, you know, at best overblown. But the next crisis won't be COVID. It will be, you know, global warming or the next virus or, you know, a terrorist scare or something like that. We need to make sure that there's someone in Parliament with consistent values that oppose government overreach, because people are going to be scared. They're going to deliberately scare people into giving the government more power. We need someone there that's going to say no at every stop. And I think the Liberal Democrats have proven that we can do that in Victoria. So I'm hoping at least that David and Tim get re-elected. And there's eight upper house regions in Victoria. If we could end up with four MPs, five MPs in the Victorian upper house, it would ensure that we'd be the balance of power in the Victorian upper house and nothing could pass without us.
Yeah, it's absolutely crucial that that there is an opposition against anything that's going on out there, and that's leading us down this pathway. I mean, goodness me, we were served up with the monkeypox nonsense, and we've all known what's happened to that story. It's just literally evaporated into thin air. I wonder what Tedros is thinking over there at the World Health Organization, when he went against his own people and voted against them and overruled them and said, no, it is an international crisis. Well, Tedros should be eating some crow now, and at least we've got past that one. So now we're seeing some form, some real form, that the authorities don't always get it right. In fact, when they all go in hard as they did, it's kind of the opposite. They will get it 100% wrong. We should all be encouraged. Going to pause for news headlines. When we come back, we're going to talk to Rob about more of his specialty, being the New South Wales State Policy Director, about the plans for the party in next year's New South Wales State elections. This is TNT Radio.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. There's been a series of major developments in the colossal cyber attack that's impacted nearly half of Australia's population. Hackers are now demanding ransom payments from individual victims. A man in the US state of Michigan has pleaded guilty to murdering, cutting up and eating the body of a man who he'd met on a gay dating app. And 11 children and 6 adults have been shot and killed at a school in Russia.
For all the latest community events, rallies, marches, festivals, and fundraisers happening near you, visit the What's On Events calendar on the TNT Radio website at tntradio.live. Stay in touch on TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Jason Q, Citizen and Friends. I'm here with Rob Cribb of the New South Wales Liberal Democrats. Rob, talking about New South Wales next year, the election is due to be held in March every 4 years on a specific date. The party is also gearing up to run in that election. What are the plans overall?
Well, we've just had our first ever members' vote to recommend a candidate to the state executive. And I think this is really important, that if we want to be a party of liberal democracy, as is our name, but, you know, potentially might not be our name for much longer, but that's another story. That we need to engage our members in our selections of candidates. So we've recently had a democratic plebiscite to let the members have their say on who the lead candidate should be in New South Wales. So we've just had that. So it's not binding. The state executive will consider that as well as interviews with the candidates. But I think it's a great step forward in internal democracy in our party and making our party a real party of the members who belong to it. And not just like the major parties where, you know, a few donors and executive members determine everything that happens. So I think that's a real great step forward in our planning for New South Wales. We're the only small party that does that. So the Liberal Party have started doing it because people would burn the building down if they didn't. But no other party does that. So I think that's a real positive for our party, that we're giving members an incentive to join because they have a say in who their representatives will be once they do. So we've just had that. Quite soon, in the next week or so, we will announce who that candidate is after we evaluate the results of that members' poll and the interviews that we've done with the potential candidates. And then after that, we'll start our campaign for the New South Wales election. And similar to the Victorian election, we'll be talking about prosperity, cost of living, and ensuring that, you know, this great tyranny can never happen again.
And so the theme is the same across, across the country, across the world now, and it seems pretty obvious that there are those that that would like to hand over their responsibility. This seems to be the theme of the modern era now, that no one wants to be responsible for anything that goes wrong in their lives. And of course, when you have something that's beyond the scope of most people, oh goodness me, there's a virus, government save me, let's go along with it. But there are those that say that that overreach is simply too much and a bridge too far, and I will not be tolerating. For mine, when you breach informed consent, when you tell me that I have to put something in my arm, when you threaten me with my job, when you tell me that I've got to put my kids, that they have to take something that's an experiment that they don't need whatsoever, that these are all lines and mass warnings. And when I feel unsafe to send my kids to school for fear that they are going to be peer pressured into taking a vaccine, or worse, just be given one without my knowledge or consent, is just when the system is completely broken. So I'm thankful, Rob, that parties such as the Liberal Democratic Party are organized, are building strength and are building resilience and are following in processes that are clearly saying that there is a lot more to this. And I appreciate both sides of the argument there, where you're holding a non-binding members event. I think it's a sign of strength within the party to say that we're not going to necessarily just take the members the way that they're doing it. The Labor Party themselves did something very similar when they went through the parliamentarian and the membership base, which ironically, Rob, that first ever vote that they did in the Labor Party was between Bill Shorten and Anthony Albanese for leader. Albo won the vote from the members, from the rank and file, but he lost it in the parliamentarians, and of course ended up becoming prime minister all those years later. So who knows what the writing on the wall is, and whether the candidate that you select will be the same one that the members selected is very interesting, and we'll look forward to that announcement when it comes out. And it's just nice to see that the Liberal Democrats are a party of the people representing a certain position. And also we will see in due course an increase in policy awareness and all those policies that are going on. But right now, acting as a check and balance with qualification is a very, very big deal that is desperately needed in our parliament when we see this one-eyed mono uni party that is forming between the Liberal and the Labor parties. If we can just sort of shift trajectory for a moment, the biggest story I feel in this country, well, there's two big stories. The Optus hack has become the biggest story. It's massive because it goes right into the face of those that are pushing for digital ID and vaccine passports and digital money, etc. And when you tie that in, and then you look at the interest rate going through the roof, 4.5% rises in a row. Now with the US going up 0.75%, Sweden going up 1%, you feel like Philip Lowe will be chomping at the bit to go another 0.5% again next week when the RBA meets in this country. But the RBA themselves, in their bond buying story, they've sent themselves into almost a form of bankruptcy. What's your take on what the RBA's up to?
Yeah, so there's been a lot of people complaining about them, saying that they're technically not insolvent. And it is true that they're not insolvent because they can create more money out of thin air. And it's colloquially called printing money, but what they do is they just, you know, adjust zeros on a ledger. So it is true that they can do that. But it's important to realize that this should not just be considered like hand-waving. There are implications to this. So if there's more money in the economy, the money that you have in your savings account is worth less. So just for a thought experiment, if you have $1 in your account, but there's only $1,000 in the entire economy, but we have the same amount of goods and services, then you're actually quite rich, right? So if you have one out of $1,000 in the entire economy, you have a lot of purchasing power. But if all of a sudden there's not $1,000 in the economy, there's $100,000, and you still only have $1, your purchasing power has gone down a lot. So putting more money into the economy is taxed by stealth. So they have taxed you without actually taking your money. They have just made your money worth less. This is effectively what inflation actually is. So the Austrian School of Economics even defines inflation differently to how our overlords at the RBA do. They just define it as the amount of money in the economy. So if we're all worried about inflation and the RBA says, oh, we're not insolvent, we're just going to print more money, that's only going to create more inflation. which then has to be offset with higher interest rates. So this answer they're giving as to why they're not insolvent, it does mean they're not insolvent, but it's not an answer we should be comfortable with if that's how they're going to solve it.
The idea of raising interest rates to slow inflation is one that's always bugged me, because if you're a person holding cash, you get a pay rise. And if you're a person that has more debt in your mortgage than you do in your bank account, then you're actually going to pay more to live in the same house. So it depends on how wealthy you are, whether or not the rising interest rates affects you. So if you've got more people that are wealthy in any economy, they're actually technically getting a pay rise, aren't they?
Yeah, in a way. So how rising interest rates does curb inflation, and I will put it out there that I actually think we've had artificially low interest rates for about 15 years, and it's just catching up with us, primarily due to the COVID response. But how rising interest rates does curb inflation is that it does reduce the amount of money in circulation. So if you rise interest rates, you'll have less people borrowing money and more people saving money. So there'll be less money actually out there competing for goods. So that's how you actually reduce prices, is you increase interest rates. And this is the only tool that the Reserve Bank has. So, you know, when the only tool you've got is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. If they see high inflation, they increase interest rates, and they do it by, you know, manipulating government bonds and stuff like that. They don't just unilaterally declare interest rates are higher. They do actually sort of manipulate the market, so they do end up higher in reality. But this has basically come as a response, well, initially due to poor monetary and fiscal policy for a decade. But ultimately, the real kicker was the government's response to COVID, where they basically decided that they were going to ban being productive and pay massive corporations lots of money not to sack people. You can't do that and not expect inflation. That's just obvious. The Liberal Democrats were calling this out at the time. So JobKeeper was obviously inflationary. And both major parties came out at the time and said, no, it'll be fine. And as they'd said for the last 15 years about all their other inflationary policies, that it would be fine. And it might have even been short-term fine if they hadn't just had 15 years of ridiculous inflationary policies, but they had. And it wasn't so much the straw that broke the camel's back. It was the anchor that broke the camel's back. But there was already, you know, a lot of straw on the camel's back when that happened. So we're already heading towards this, but this certainly was the tipping point where being productive was illegal, and the government was going to print new money to give to big corporations not to sack people. This is how you get a lot more money in the economy without actually having more productivity. And that's definition inflation.
Yeah, well said. Beautifully put, actually. Moving across now and looking at the idea of the Optus hack and what that means in terms of the push now towards a digital ID, because, of course, the second part of the tyrannical approach to not only printing money to keep people artificially in jobs and making productivity illegal, well said, Rob, was the push towards a vaccine passport, proof that you could re-enter society because you were safe. Didn't matter that the safety that they were giving you was flawed and was dangerous and was actually killing people, and happy to say that here on TNT Radio. Where do we go next now that the Optus hack has exposed the idea of digital identity now in this country? People must now be wary.
Absolutely. And I think this goes back to the metadata laws in 2017. So it became compulsory for Optus to keep a lot of information on their customers by the government in 2017. And a lot of people on the right side of politics who I associate with, they supported this at the time. They thought it was good to stop, you know, terrorism and child porn, which is the duo that, you know, everyone will always be scared with first before that, you know, it drips down to everything else in society when you have government overreach. So Optus had to keep this data by government fiat. They absolutely had to. Now that they've been hacked, the data that they had to keep on their customers is now available to everyone. And I think this does have grave implications for, you know, what people like us have been talking about for a while with digital identity. If you keep a, a centralized location where, you know, exactly where everyone went shopping and their carbon footprint and, you know, who they called and everything like that to determine this digital identity. It's not secure. You know, Optus probably had, in theory, one of the most secure databases in the world, but, you know, you have a lazy employee, something goes wrong, all of a sudden all of this is exposed. So it's not secure at all. And a centralized database of everyone's identities would be a prime target for hacking. It wouldn't just be something that was easy to hack. It would be something that everyone was trying to hack every day. So this is one potential downside of digital identity. I could go through another 14, 15 downsides of it, but this has certainly exposed one of them. It's certainly proven that the 2017 metadata laws that the Liberal Democrats at the time advised people, you know, would eventually backfire, have backfired in a massive way.
Yeah, well said. Now, last Friday on the program, I had Alexandra Marshall from The Spectator, and she made a very interesting point about digital money, and that was that if you take away cash and everyone's running on a digital government centralized cryptocurrency, then if the Reserve Bank or the government can set interest rates, there's nothing to stop them from setting a negative interest rate, and you literally watch your own wealth evaporate. What's your take on that comment?
I think she's totally correct. And you've thrown me a bit by asking me an Alexandra question, but I will move on. I think she's totally correct. I think that there's even like people in this world today without digital currency that believe in negative interest rates, including the supposedly libertarian Center for Independent Studies. So Peter Chulip believes in negative interest rates. And this is an organization that a lot of libertarians, including myself, have given money to in the past. I think this is very dangerous that we have someone in the CIS who is calling for negative interest rates. They had negative interest rates briefly in Japan. This is even without a digital currency. So I certainly think Alexandra is correct that as soon as we have a digital currency, it makes it a lot easier to have negative interest rates. They become less logistically ridiculous. And this takes away the absolute floor that you get, so that we can't just have like lower interest rates artificially forever, because once we get to zero, we kind of hit a point of no return. If you can have negative interest rates, you almost never hit a point of return, and you just slowly walk to the edge of a productivity cliff. It would be disastrous if we ever had negative interest rates in Australia. And I think having a digital currency that's manipulated by the government, which is different to if you actually had like a private cryptocurrency, which was decentralized, it would make it quite easy for them to do that. And it would be disastrous.
We're going to take a break. There's probably a little bit more we need to talk about in terms of negative interest rates, one of which would be the idea that if the Reserve Bank had literally printed almost $1 trillion during COVID, what was to stop them from putting that at the time when interest rates were actually negative in this country, at least officially, or they could have been in terms of what they were selling their bonds for? Why couldn't they lock up $1 trillion at negative 1% interest rate for 100 years and just let it pay itself off, such as the way that economics is literally just reinventing itself in the moment in these unprecedented times? I'm going to take that quick break. When we come back, more with Rob Cribb here on TNT Radio.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
So who knew that the state of California is 45% smarter than the state of New York? Or are they? Well, according to published reports, last winter, both states purchased the same COVID-19 home test, but New York paid about 45% more per test than California. The Times Union reports New York Governor Kathy Hochul's administration bought 52 million of the CareStar tests manufactured by the New Jersey-based firm Access Bio. Now, unlike California, New York purchased tests through an intermediary, New Jersey-based distributor Digital Gadgets, a company owned by a New York family that has, get this, donated nearly $300,000 to Hochul's campaign. California bought the tests directly from Access Bio. So why would Hochul's administration use the intermediary owned by a family that donated big time to her campaign? Let's have an investigation to find out and hope that in the meantime, she doesn't win re-election in November. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg on TNT Radio.
It's 4 a.m., Monday, and you're literally sucking baby snot through a tube because she's congested. Man, that's love. And if you love her that much, love her enough to make sure she's buckled in the right car seat. To make sure your child's in the right seat for their age and size, visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Show them you love them. Keep them safe. Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat. Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
We have every right to believe Ukraine funds are being money laundered, unless proven otherwise. Today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to the Jason Q Citizen and Friends program, and I hope you're enjoying this program as much as I am today. It's been absolutely riveting to have both Rob and George on the program, and it's probably one of those moments where you might just say, you know what? What else are they doing here on TNT Radio? Who else can I listen to? And I tell you what, I go through on the app, the various different presenters, and have a look at the guests that they've had on. I mean, Jeremy Nell, who was on my program last week, one of our presenters from South Africa, he's got David Icke on his show this week. He's had recently Reiner Fulmick on his program, and Right Said Fred. Wow. George had recently had Paul Manafort on his program, and that would certainly be compelling interest. Steve Kirsch, if you want to get the latest on what's happening in terms of vaccines, and Peter Navarro, who worked the entire time during the Trump presidency in that administration. So there's some pretty substantial guests coming through every day, and more are coming on. And Rob, it's your turn, and I'm delighted that you're here with me today, and we can explore more on the economics of what's going on. But this idea of a digital currency, it frightens me, and it's not just because of the possibility of watching our wealth evaporate, but it's the idea of control. It's the idea that a third party is privy to anything in my financial world, and I say that that alone is the line in the sand. What's your take?
Yeah, I agree. So I think having a digital currency would give far more control to the government than it already has over our finances. And I think it would even allow for, you know, it sounds a bit tinfoil hat, but in theory, if the government has control over our finances to that degree, they could determine if we weren't vaccinated, they could automatically freeze our entire ability with a combination of a digital currency and a digital identity to spend money at all. Or they could say that any money we spent had an automatic 7% tax if we had a bad carbon footprint. This is not totally fanciful once they bring these things in. These aren't things that everyone disagrees should happen, which is why I think it's not fanciful. So if you go and discuss these matters with people who supported mask mandates, and they say, and you say, look, should you automatically have to pay a tax if you have a really bad carbon footprint or if your kids aren't vaccinated? Most of them will say yes. So I think this is something a digital currency and a digital identity system would enable fairly quickly. So I think that the idea of giving them the power to do this is quite dangerous, even if people don't think it's going to happen immediately. I think the ability to do it is the problem more than the actual likelihood of it.
This is the hard part of is the idea that anything that looks like it's more than one step ahead for the average person in the street, if it's not shown to them on mainstream news, they simply just say, oh, tinfoil conspiracy, not interested, forget about it, don't care, and that's where it goes. Now, as a perspective, it was Elon Musk that came out a couple of years ago and suggested that we are already living inside a matrix. My argument in that regard is the fact that once you are compulsorily made to do something on a collective scale, and a compulsory vaccine was one of those attempts, well, at that point, you're no longer human, you are a you are under the control of another human, and it kind of degrades us as a species. Do you think that Musk's comments there of living in a matrix or living outside of a genuine reality are realistic, are genuine, are something that we should be aware and concerned of?
Well, I certainly think your take on it is correct. So whether or not, you know, everyone interprets him saying we live in a matrix in the same way is, you know, up for debate. But I think this is what you said. This is why rights are individual. So we don't really have group rights, even though, you know, governments and the United Nations and organizations like that will try and tell us that they are preserving our group rights. Group rights don't really exist. We think individually. We act individually. So we don't, you know, we don't have a committee meeting to decide whether or not to raise our left hand. So rights are individual. We can form groups based on our individual rights and protect those groups with those individual rights. But these are why rights are individual and why we should recognize them as such.
Yeah, look, well said, Rob. It's interesting, isn't it, when you just take a perspective as simple as that rights are individual, you can start to realize that, again, that the human being, the individual, is sacred. And this again goes back to what Georgia Maloney has said in her speech yesterday when she accepted becoming the new Prime Minister of Italy. And I might just refer to some of that when she said, why is the family an enemy? Why is the family so frightening? There is a simple answer to all these questions because it defines us. It is our identity because everything that defines us is now an enemy. For those who would like us to no longer have an identity and to simply be perfect consumer slaves, and so they attack national identity, they attack religious identity, they attack gender identity, and they attack family identity. She says, I can no longer define myself as Italian, Christian, woman, mother. No, I must be citizen X, gender X, parent one, parent two, I must be a number. Now, that ties in very nicely to what you just said before about rights being individual, but it appears that by removing your identity, then you become part of the collective and the right. This is at the very essence of the transition from where we are into this disgusting new world order, Rob.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. So those identities that she listed, a lot of them she joined voluntarily with her individual rights, or that they were, you know, part of her identity that she was born into, that she decided that she wanted to defend with her individual rights. So I think this is very important that, you know, a criticism of what I'm saying sometimes misses the point. So if I say rights of individual and people will say, okay, so that means that my group identity as, you know, a woman or as Italian or things that she's saying, that they don't count, but they do. They do count. And these are things that you can care about with your individual rights and you can defend them with your individual rights. But your rights exist as an individual and they don't exist as part of some grand collective that, you know, an overseeing government will determine for you. I think this is the criticisms of what I'm saying sometimes miss the point in that way. So I'm glad you recognize the fact that it was consistent with what she said. That I said what I had said previously.
Now, with the passing of the Queen, the conversation has commenced with the idea of the Republican movement. It beggars belief that it would be a bunch of lefty globalists such as Peter Fitzsimons that would be leading the cause here. And I note that their traction on social media is a little bit less than desired. It's probably just too soon. But when they've got all their merchandise at 50% off, one sees that this may be not the the start that they were looking for. Have you got a position where Australia may head towards going forward in the era of King Charles III?
So I'd like to preface this by saying this is just my personal opinion, not like a Liberal Democrats New South Wales policy opinion, because the Liberal Democrats doesn't have a policy on it either way. But I certainly think a constitutional monarchy is far preferable to any other system proposed, especially by Peter Fitzsimons. So I think ultimately what we're going to have a head of state, I think it would be better if a head of state is ceremonial and revered like the monarch, instead of having President Rudd, which I basically think is the alternative. So I certainly, I think a constitutional monarchy is far preferable. I think that's what we're going to get. If we have an elected president in Australia, we're going to get President Rudd, we're going to get President Turnbull. They're going to be very interventionist. It's going to be a new level of government. We don't want this. So the head of state that we've had, the governor general and the queen for the last little era that we've had, have not intervened at all unless absolutely necessary, and really only once, and it was absolutely necessary. So I think this is the sort of head of state we want. We don't want a new level of government where we can have Kevin Rudd or Malcolm Turnbull sort of putting out executive orders. This would be disastrous. This would be much more government, much more intervention, much less freedom for Australians. So I think I certainly have a preference for a constitutional monarchy in that way. The Liberal Democrats don't have a firm position on it because we have, some Republicans in our party, and we're more focused on the role of government than the form of government. But I personally have that opinion very strongly.
Thank you. We've run out of time, Rob. Just quickly, in 5 seconds, just tell us the Liberal Democrats website, please.
That's ldp.org.au.
Wonderful. That's been Rob Cribb, the current New South Wales Policy Director. Thank you, Rob, for being on the show. I'd love to have you back to discuss more details in the future and to follow back on what's happening with the elections coming up. Lots more after the break, including Rick Munn. Don't go anywhere, the one and only TNT Radio.